169th Fighter Wing, and welcome to the February edition of Fox Chatter. This is Vito back with you again. We're going to talk about current events in the wing, and then I also have two special guests today, Colonel Jeff Beeve Smith and Staff Sergeant Mitch Duncan. We'll talk to Beeve first, and then we'll talk to Mitch. Beeve is going to give us a little bit of information about what the med group's been up to and what their deployable UTC, the CCAT, is. And really exciting to me is we're going to talk to Mitch Duncan, and he's going to give us an overview of what our Swamp Fox at Prince Sultan Air Base are dealing with in terms of real-world events, and then some intel behind Typhoon Fox and what's going on in the other part of the world. As you know, our focus for this year is Typhoon Fox, and so we've been kind of crawling through ACE training up to this point, which is good. I don't mean that in a negative at all. We've been crawling as we develop our capabilities, and our March exercise is going to be our first opportunity to walk. Hopefully you've all seen my commander's intent document that kind of spells out where we're going. There's going to be a whole lot more details coming out over this drill so that you have this drill in the following month to prepare for the March exercise. But I really like the plan and the way that that plan is going. After March, we have a pretty good idea. We're getting closer to a July, August TDY that I'm not going to talk about too much because I don't want to jinx it, but it's going in the right direction right now. But that will be another great opportunity to get better at ACE, and we should be jogging by then. And then October for our midpoint is coming into focus a little bit more. It's looking like we're likely tasked for a TDY to Tyndall as a pre-POTUS spin-up in late October. And then that will likely be a phase one tied in with that for our midpoint. So I think that's going the way we want it to go. So that's Typhoon Fox. Other things that have been going on over the last month. We had our FAFE, First Air Force Fighter Assessment, which is the actual inspection down at alert, and it went really well. I just want to thank everyone down at ACA, the red, white, and blue teams, the pilots that are operating there, the command post team, and then everyone behind the scenes for a great job. Over the last couple years, we've shifted the way we've looked at alert a little bit. And instead of having a dedicated force that was really locked down, to get more people in and to get more out of the mission, and honestly, to enable us to pivot a bit towards more advanced training and Typhoon Fox, we've gone with a more rapid swap out of personnel. We've gone with more personnel touching ACA instead of just a dedicated core. And it was an acceptance of risk, because when you had a dedicated core down there, I mean, they just crushed it. But there were sacrifices that were made on the other side. And so we made a conscious decision to accept a little bit more risk. And so this assessment was really interesting, and it went really well. The evaluators said across the board, above average. Command post, command and control, above average. Security forces, unfortunately, was not evaluated because their evaluator couldn't make it out. I have no doubt they would have done outstanding as well. Ops and maintenance, both above average. So it was really nice to know that we accepted a little bit more risk and that it still went really well. So that was a nice validation of our plan. And so I want to thank the people that are there now. I also want to thank the people that had been there for years and years and set the foundation in place, right? Like you can't go to that accepting of additional risk and bringing in people that are a little bit less experienced in the ACA mission if you don't have this outstanding foundation that was laid over the course of years and years. So thanks to everyone who set that up. An awesome job on the FAFE. It's a, you know, we didn't talk about it a ton because you kind of want to keep the pressure down, but it's a big deal. So doing as well as they did on the FAFE is a really big deal, and nice job. We also had a CCZ inspection, which is our advanced program shop. And that one, I want to give them a shout out as well. The entire CCZ team, which starts with Lieutenant Colonel Blevins, and then goes to the program security managers with John Bonovich and David Green, and then just goes down throughout that entire shop and gets into more people than I can say, unfortunately. They did a great job, and they were handed a big challenge. Sometimes you are handed situations that are beyond your control. And in this case, the CCZ team was handed a really tough one with some situations that they couldn't control, some inspectors that I would say maybe didn't have the perspective that I shared, and they had some concepts that I didn't think were necessarily reasonable. And one of the things I will say that is also very important to us is we have to be able to take a punch and bounce back and be resilient. And I will tell you, the CCZ team took a punch to the face and they handled it with class. And they did fine on the inspection, not what they wanted to do, but they did fine. And they took a punch that was outside of their control and they handled it with class, and they are just continuing to work through it. And sometimes that just happens in your military career. There are just situations beyond your control, situations that you inherit or things that you can't control. And they end up being, you know, a punch in the gut. And you just got to be able to take it. And you got to be able to be resilient enough, professional enough, mature enough to handle it and move on. And so that's what that team has done. And I'm really proud of them for that. And because sometimes things aren't always just sunshine and rainbows. They're rough. And you got to be able to manage the rough stuff as well. And they did just fine on the inspection. They took their punch and we're all moving on from it. Now, granted, maybe we're sending a few punches back their way. Maybe I got some things up my sleeve still. But overall, we're handling it professionally and we're moving on. So thanks to everyone on that team for that. Also want to give a few shout outs to people that have just been doing awesome lately. I'm going to start with the annual award winners because that's a really big deal. The unit of the year was the 169th Comptroller Flight. Anyone who's been around me lately has heard me talk about what a great job they have done. Talk about taking punches and being handed messes. Try dealing with DFAS all the time and that labyrinthine system of just ridiculousness that they have to operate in every day. And the team there managing that, putting new processes in place. I have personally watched the number of issues with pay. They're not gone, nor will they ever be gone, but steadily decline due to a lot of effort on their part in managing that. So they're the unit of the year. Thanks very much to them. The family of the year was Master Sergeant David Gilbert's family. Awesome job. Thank you for your support. Our airman of the year was Senior Airman Nathan Queen. NCO of the year was Tech Sergeant Nicholas Ramsey. Senior NCO of the year was Master Sergeant William Browder. Our CGO of the year was Lieutenant Sidney Bird. FGO of the year was Major Brady Fuel Augustine. And our civilian of the year, Mr. Michael Bokikia, known affectionately as Bo. And our first sergeant of the year, Master Sergeant Gary Ballier. Thank you, everyone, and great job. In addition to that, I'd like to give a shout out to Master Sergeant Jessica Geary and Master Sergeant Nick Franklin over in IPR and LGX for the great job they did getting our people out the door. And that job continues as we handle our swap outs and continue to work the return. Great job there. And then finally, I want to talk about, and I save this for last because I don't like talking about things that I haven't been able to fix, but I also don't want you to think that I'm not paying attention to them and they're not important to me. So in the comment box, we get the issues and I don't forget about any of them. So one of the issues that was mentioned a while back, and it was even a long time coming at that, is the back gate, and the back gate's still not done and the parts still aren't in. And I don't know what else to do about that. Unfortunately, no one at the wing level or at the CE level can manufacture actuators for the gate. And so I can't answer why they're not in. I'm frustrated. CE can't answer it, and it's not their fault that they can't. We can't get results right now. And all I can tell you is we're trying to manage it with the balance of professionalism and understanding, but at the same time, accountability. And so we're working on it. And, you know, just like the last time and the time before, like, it's always 1 month away. And so maybe it's 1 month away this time, or maybe I'll be talking about it next month. Know that me having to talk about it every month, though, is embarrassing enough. And so that helps me keep pressure on it. Fire department. Oh my gosh, that one, unfortunately, it's not going anywhere fast either. We did negotiating a couple of months ago with the company that had the insurance when the contractor fell through. And we thought we were getting close to a negotiated settlement to get some more money and get it started again. And that hasn't moved. Man, I wish I could make it move. And I can't right now. The trailers also were my saving grace for at least I can do something good for these great American firefighters that have been out of their building for a long time. And the trailers that we had our eyes on that Richland County was going to fund with the grant that Colonel Hummel and his team were able to get, well, those trailers are gone. And so now we're trying to get new trailers. That's late breaking news. And so I'll lean into that in any way that I can to help them out. But obviously feel terrible for their situation and very anxious to get them in some trailers. That would just make me feel better. Last input that I got was, Vito, can we bring back the technician Christmas party? And, you know, like I say, usually when you get an input like that in the comment box, it means, you know, times 10 or 20 or 50 people are thinking the same thing. So I'm glad that one got brought up. I actually have heard it before. And Hyde and I talking about it a little bit. And in the aftermath of Winterfest, we talked a little bit about how we want to revamp Winterfest. And so I don't have a 100% answer for you, but one of the things we want to do next year around Christmas time is incorporate awards somehow. And whether that means re-adding a separate technician party or incorporating that into Winterfest and doing an awards portion of that, maybe for our annual awards and for our technician awards, we're looking at everything right now. We're going to keep working on that and coming up with something for next year. Obviously, that's a little bit of far rocks right now. Please keep those inputs coming. I really appreciate them. I would actually like to see a lot more things that you've noticed, things that you don't like, maybe even things that you like. So keep the inputs coming. My first guest today is Colonel Jeff Beeve Smith, commander of the 169th Medical Group. I asked Beeve to come here today and talk to us a little bit about what they would do in a deployed environment. And one of their UTCs, deployable UTCs, is a CCAT team. Welcome first. And can you tell us a little bit about the CCAT team?
Sure. Thanks for having me, sir. CCAT, so Critical Care Air Transport Team. It's a three-member team, comprised of a physician specialized in critical care, a critical care nurse, and a respiratory therapist. And their job, put simply, is to create a flying ICU and bring our warriors home. They are equipped with about 72 hours worth of supplies. They can make an ICU out of just about anything that flies.
So yeah, that was going to be my next question. So they are trained on any aircraft, C-130, C-17, helos, all of the above?
All of the above. When it began back in 94, 96, the concept was kind of born out of two physicians with a shopping cart in the ICU storage closet and seeing how much equipment can we bring and how many patients will that take care of. Originally designed on cargo airplanes, but it has fairly quickly evolved into any airframe. CCAT teams, you give them three seat belts in 6 feet of space per stretcher for a patient, and they can make it work.
Awesome. So you got a three-person team. How many of these three-person teams are in the UTC?
Right now, we only have one team. However, we have enough qualified personnel to accept a second one.
And it's my understanding that a second UTC is imminent.
Hopefully. Yes. So I think recent manning changes and all that have kind of maybe delayed the reassignments from one unit to another and all that kind of good stuff. So it's these teams are distributed, you know, nationwide to all the units.
So these CCAT teams, are they currently in being deployed
they
to
are.
The Middle East or other AORs, and are they being utilized frequently?
Several AORs, yeah. Yes. So we've had two of our members who have deployed as part of a CCAT or a ground surgical team, which is a whole another realm, as a critical care nurse and for both teams, one in 22, and then we had one guy just get back recently.
Yeah. Right.
And one was in PACAF and the other one was in AFSAT.
And was it their feeling over there that these teams were utilized effectively and this is an important cog that goes into the machine?
Yes. One guy in particular was extremely busy flying all over the Pacific.
Was that Josh?
That was Josh.
Okay.
Yeah, Josh.
Major Josh Davis.
Yes. Yep. And then Lieutenant Colonel Brian Walsh was over there at PSAB, actually, And he actually did a lot of stuff with the Army, going downrange on helicopters to grab injured people and bring them back to PSAV, and then ultimately, you know, they would get transferred elsewhere.
Awesome. And that's what we need you guys to be doing. Can you talk to me about your construct, Beav, that you built last year, MedFlag, how that builds into the CCAT team and your other missions, and where you're going with MedFlag?
Yeah, sure. So MedFlag, it began as a concept during COVID when we were doing joint operations in response to a global pandemic. And the Army side and the air side and state agencies and civilian agencies found themselves having to work together and starting to speak new languages and learning how to communicate. And it looked great. It was fantastic. We worked well together and we accomplished a lot of things. And during that time, the Army found themselves needing EMT refresher training. And on the air side, we have an EMT instructor on orders right now. Bada boom, bada bing, we got him trained. And they have patient decon on that side. We needed decon training. They've got incredible equipment. And so we really did not only joint operations in response to COVID, but joint training. And the concept developed from there. Like, well, pretty sure active duty medical does yearly training, very similar. Let's Absolutely. Get them involved.
Yes.
Life flight, right? That's basically medevac. They have to do yearly training. So we're drawing in all kinds of personnel from active duty, state, civilian agencies to come in and do this now. It's really grown this year.
So when is it this year and how big do you see it being?
So last year, well, we had three agencies. We had Army Guard, Air Guard, Medical, and we plugged into their current flying schedule for their helicopters. And then Prisma brought in their simulation lab, a couple of their instructors. So it was three of us over 2 days. This year, it's in May, the 2nd and the 3rd, a Thursday and Friday prior to drill.
Okay.
And currently, I don't know if we have this much time for me to list all these entities, but Prisma Health Richland is bringing in somewhere between 60 and over 100 people over a two-day period of time. They're bringing their simulation van, their sim center, a mass casualty bus. I still got to coordinate with Shaw and exactly what we can do with them. Army, Air, the Coast Guard from down in Charleston has expressed some interest. The Charleston Reserve has penciled themselves in for not only their air evac squadron, but a C-17. The North Carolina Air Guard is interested in joining. I think they're penciled themselves in.
So that speaks to me, just obviously, you have an idea, you throw it out there, it's very popular. Everyone wants this training. They want the joint training. They want to be here. They've been waiting for someone to throw something together that they can participate in. And I would say, you know, from my perspective, and I think probably everyone else listening to this, like, man, proud to be a Swamp Fox when, you know, our medical group throws something like this together. It's something that is real world applicable in terms of whether it's a homeland situation or even not a situation, but just life in general. And the EMTs are better trained and you guys are better trained for when we actually do deploy, which is what we want and need you guys to be doing.
Yeah. And it's really based on the theory that, hey, you have your equipment, right? So bring your equipment, bring your people, be prepared to teach and be prepared to learn. We are the instructors and we are the students. So it is really a participation-based event and it can cover anything. If you come to teach it, you will have people to learn.
Yeah. That's great. I appreciate you putting that together. Anything else you want to throw out there, Beav, before we wrap it up?
Well, I got to actually, the thanks really goes to Major Davis and then this year, Lieutenant Pomazzano. They both really attacked this concept. It was amazing to see the two of them take an idea that I had and just make it into something incredible.
Yep. I've worked with both of them. Great human beings, great officers. Yeah, fortunate to have people. Them both.
Yep.
Thanks, Beav.
Yes, sir. Appreciate it.
Okay, my next guest is Staff Sergeant Mitch Duncan. Mitch, welcome to Fox Chatter.
Thank you for having me.
Glad to have you. And thanks for volunteering to come on over. I'd like to talk a little bit about, because I don't know very much about it and I need to know more. Can you talk a little bit about the situation in Yemen and the Houthis? Specifically, who are they? What are they up to? And why are they doing what they're doing?
Sure. The Houthis are a militant group in Yemen, one of three major ones. They are a Shia Muslim group that felt marginalized since the 80s, 90s by a Sunni government in Yemen that was backed by Saudi Arabia, of course, being Sunni. So that's where you'll see the Iranian line militia group talk with Houthi, and the connection there is first and obvious is Shia, the Shia Muslim, and then secondly, you're going to have needling Saudi Arabia is always a goal of Iran.
And Yemen is a very poor country, correct?
Extremely
not a whole
poor.
Lot of oil resources there.
They are the poorest Arabian country.
Okay, so that's probably one of our lead-in factors to why things are so unstable there in the first place. And then they have the standard Middle East Shia Sunni challenges there as well.
Yes, sir.
Okay.
And then so they have been fighting for more control, more representation in Yemen, and very successfully, actually, taking a large swath of territory in Yemen at this point. And Saudi Arabia, if you remember, even back during the Obama administration, 2015, they launched a kind of a coalition with United Arab Emirates to defend the previous government, the Sunni government in Yemen. The U.S. did not directly get involved with that conflict. However, we did provide munitions for Saudi Arabia, refueling, stuff like that, support we would see at bases like PSAP and others, which ended up turning badly because Saudi Arabia isn't as good as dropping bombs as Americans are. A lot of civilians died. There was a lot of blowback from their national community. And that's kind of where why they stopped. And now there's been ceasefire talks between Saudi Arabia and the Houthis. Saudi Arabia no longer wants to do this fight because the Houthis fought back to Saudi after these strikes. So launching ballistic missiles, cruise missiles, one-way attack drones, things like that. And you've seen things like that over at Prince Sultan Air Base the last 7 years or so that weren't directly targeting these U.S. bases, but were targeting Saudi Arabia interests. And of course, the base being in Saudi Arabia, it is very close to these threats.
So the Houthis, so if I recall right, the Saudis were very deep in this campaign. Were they using precision-guided munitions?
Yes, sir.
And they just weren't as good with them?
So the argument was, then there's probably a combination of these three factors being just not as good with the munitions, maybe directly targeting some of these civilian things to put damage, you know, and hurt them. And then third, Houthis were kind of similar to when you see Hamas using, where they will operate out of hospitals, things like that. I'm not sure there's one good answer. It's probably a combination of all three of those.
Okay. And then the Houthis, who are furnished weapons by Iran primarily?
Yes, sir.
Is it exclusively or primarily?
Exclusively, all of probably runs through Iran. However, you also have like Somalia there in those areas.
Sure.
And they can get them, but that's all coming through Iran anyways. But they also have the ability to make their own, right? You don't just give them out of fish, right? You can teach them. So Iran has taught them how to make their own. So they no longer necessarily need Iran to function. They have their own capabilities now. They've developed a lot further than since 2015.
So they've taken this funding, weapons from Iran. They struck back against Saudi Arabia. Pretty bad, right? If I recall right, Saudi Arabia felt pretty damaged or threatened by what the Houthis were able to do, which led to, if I recall, some sort of fragile peace agreement in Yemen.
Yep. So yeah, they got struck back pretty hard. Saudi Arabia no longer wanted this fight. International blowback. Remember at the beginning of the Biden administration, they removed the foreign terrorist organization label from the Houthis, stuff like that. So Saudi Arabia has been negotiating with the Houthis for a long time now. And right now there's a fragile peace agreement. It's probably not a great word for it, but ceasefire.
Ceasefire.
Right now, Saudi Arabia is trying to kind of pull out of that fight. Not sure where that's going to go, though, if that's going to hold, especially right now with coming into, you know, today with Prosperity Garden. That's the U.S. named operation to defend the shipping lanes south of Yemen from Houthis. And obviously, you've seen on the news, we've done multiple strikes, multiple TLAMs, JDAMs, and we're still striking. I think I just saw another strike last night from the U.S. and British forces on Houthi areas. So what that effect is on that ceasefire now, it comes into question. And now you're talking about before we were, PSAP wasn't the target maybe of these strikes from the Houthis, but Saudi Arabia facilities were. Now after US-UK strikes, that may be changing, especially after the latest US-UK strikes.
Makes sense. So that puts our people in PSAP definitely more in danger. And I've been talking to Colonel Quadri, and they are absolutely on edge about that. Were the Houthis attacking any traffic, shipping traffic in the Red Sea prior to the Israel-Hamas conflict?
Not immediately prior. They have previously in the last 10 years, I know. Not to this extent, for sure. But it is one way for the Houthis to grab legitimacy and look at me, kind of. You have to recognize us as a government. If they start taking boats or threatening ships, it's almost a negotiation tactic, right? And now you have to negotiate with me. If all I want is legitimacy, do you recognize me as the government of Yemen? Remove me as being a foreign terrorist organization, get more aid supplies in. So they've always had that capability and that threat, but they've been more focused on defeating. There's still a civil war going on, defeating the what is called the Royal Government of Yemen, ROG. So they've been more focused on that. There's only one major city left, actually, that the old government still holds, Marib. Okay. And the Houthis are very close to, or they were very close to taking it before the ceasefire is coming into effect.
So they were occasionally hitting traffic, but in general, Red Sea shipping traffic was flowing mostly unabated and was able to make it through the Suez Canal. And then this conflict with Israel and Hamas kicks off. And so one of my questions is, and I suspect I know the answer, but what's in it for the Houthis stopping this shipping traffic? Is there a benefit in it for them, or are they doing it because Iran is telling them to do it?
That's a great question. I think you have to look at the cost, risk, benefit, like benefit analysis for this for them. I think the risk is real heavy for them right now than the benefit. But the benefit would be kind of what I mentioned before, legitimacy. You have to recognize me, more aid, make Saudi Arabia want to negotiate with them more. You realize you hold the world at risk there. Up to, you know, I've seen numbers up to 25% of world shipping going through areas south of Yemen. And that's a huge economic effect for everybody in the world. So being able to threaten that gives you a lot of negotiating power. So that's kind of the benefit for this for them. But the risk, obviously, is Saudi Arabia going back and attacking with U.S.-backed support and really trying to degrade forces in Yemen. The issue with this, and what I imagine is the Houthis, is their game plan is that they don't think the U.S. would be willing to put boots in the ground and go in and actually defeat them, you know, and force them out. Because that'd be really hard. Yemen's a hard geography to deal with for something like that. And I don't think there's any interest from the U.S. to do that. So you're kind of in a position of power to where you kind of force everyone to negotiate with them. And that's kind of their idea by these strikes.
Hmm. Interesting. Sounds a little similar to North Korea's tactics from time to time. The spoiled kid who's just needs to get some attention and wants someone to pay attention to them and goes about it in very unsavory ways, and saw an opportunity here. And then at the same time, Iran is prodding them because they provide them with the weapons and they have a vested interest in Hamas. And so they are leveraging the Houthis. I wonder if the Houthis realize how much they're putting at risk for this, but they also know that they're being fed and funded by the Iranians. And so to some extent, I'm sure they do their bidding. Interesting. The other thing that I found very interesting and a little bit unnerving was the quality of weapons that the Houthis had in terms of radar sites and missiles. I did not suspect. I assumed much more low-tech type of piracy, like the type of thing we saw off Somalia. But it sounds like they actually have quite an infrastructure there for being able to do this.
Yes, sir. So there was a decent amount of infrastructure there, especially like U.S.-provided stuff from before the Houthis went in power in certain positions. So think like 80s, 90s U.S. tech, which is not nothing by any means. Also, Iranian tech has gotten better. Like I said before, their ability to manufacture and create these weapons and has grown exponentially over the last 10, 15 years. So it is by no means a near peer or anything like that. However, they are quite capable when it comes to at least not being able to conduct a war, but being able to hold like the Red Sea at risk. Very capable of doing that for a long period of time.
Copy. Disturbing situation over there. And obviously, thoughts and prayers with our brothers and sisters over there at PSAB. They're caught in the middle of it, depending on how things play out, how the Saudis decide whether to join or not to join, and all the politics associated with that, like you said, risk reward. Anything else that you'd like to add on the Houthis before we shift gears?
No, I would just, you know, continue looking out for these airstrikes. I think this is going to continue. And as long as the war in Gaza lasts, I think the Houthis will continue to do this. So I would keep looking out for an escalation. Maybe Hezbollah would be the biggest red line, the biggest sign of a major escalation in the Middle East right now. So if you see anything in the news about Hezbollah and Israel kind of going at it more than just generic mortar rounds or something, that would be a big thing to watch out for in the coming month.
Okay. Shifting gears, our wing focus is still on Typhoon Fox and preparing for any type of potential conflict over in the Pacific. with China, and that's what we are training for. And so I'd like to just get a little bit of an update on what the Chinese have been up to lately, how the elections in Taiwan affect things, and just your overall intel assessment of that situation.
Okay, so last couple months, biggest thing that's changed with China is the South China Sea. There's a boat called the Sierra Madre. It was a U.S. boat we gave to the Filipinos a long time ago.
Oh, yeah, I've seen this. It's basically a rusted out hulk sitting on the bottom.
And you have about 10 Filipino Marines that just sit out there, and that is their station. They ended up crashing this boat into a reef so they could make sure that they retain control of that reef so China couldn't take control.
Yep.
And but like I said, it's a very old ship. You've seen the rusted pictures. You can Google them all. Not lasting very well, and they need supplies, obviously, right? And so what China will do is they will take their either their maritime militia, civilians that kind of operate under the Chinese Communist Party, or their Coast Guard, and they'll block resupply missions from the Philippines to these 10 dudes out in the middle of the ocean on this boat. There was something called the Christmas Convoy that happened just around Christmas time, where it was a big convoy. They wanted to send, you know, obviously the basics for them, but other things too for Christmas for the guys. Who are deployment is much worse than anything we could probably imagine, just sitting in the middle of the ocean on a boat for 6 months. But China keeps blocking them. That's been the major issue right now, is China and how they're going to block Filipino vessels, remembering that the United States has a mutual defense treaty with Philippines.
Right.
So then what kind of line does it take to draw U.S. into a conflict? Obviously, I don't think we're going to with just blocking a resupply vessel, but you can see where an escalation is going to start there. Where we can go from in the future.
Okay, yep, and I have read about that a few times. I'm glad to hear that hasn't escalated, I guess, any further. It sounds like it's continuing. Do you assess it as escalating further? As I say that, I look at you and I see the nonverbal of like, hey, Vito, this actually might be getting worse.
It is. Well, not major, but we're starting to see things like water cannons be used more frequently, ramming of boats. This may not sound like a huge escalation, and it's not huge. It is a minor escalation. However, even more important than that, I think there is certainly a date coming at one point where there is going to be either the Philippines has to get their way through resupply, or they won't make it. They won't be able to hold that reef, if that makes sense. There is a little line where they will have to get past China some way.
And this is all about fishing rights, correct?
Fishing is a big one. However, I would think the biggest thing is oil and natural gas deposits that are suspected to be in the South China Sea.
Okay.
Are really big. And if you look at China, they import 70% of their energy needs. So something like that where they're maybe worried about, and this kind of goes into the grand strategy with China against the United States and that power competition, is U.S. is able to be energy independent, right? We're able to kind of lock down sea lanes if a war with China broke out. China doesn't have that energy independence. So maintaining control of those oil and gas deposits so they can reduce their imports of energy would be huge for them.
That's a great point. We don't hear about that very often. How about the election in Taiwan? I know that the leader who got elected there is the current, I think it was the vice president. Is that what they call him?
I can't remember,
Vice
but he
Premier,
was the same party
lines.
As their ruling party
right.
before.
He was the least favorable choice to China, correct?
Yes.
Okay. Any assessment on how that's going to play out?
I would imagine China, you know, always shows their displeasure with activities, the election being one big one. I would imagine you'll see more balloons being thrown over there, aircraft, multiple, like large quantity of aircraft breaking through the air defense identification zone in Taiwan, boats surrounding it. More just warning measures. I think you may start seeing a change in tactics though with China, depending on how they use it. Because a lot of times when they use these tactics, I think they've realized this, while you haven't seen that yet, is that it drives more people in Taiwan towards these parties that are anti-China. So I think China's starting to realize that by doing these escalatory actions or these threatening actions, you are driving more people away from the parties you want to win in Taiwan, which is the KMT. That is one party that is more pro-China. That's the preferred party for China. And they've seen a direct correlation of do these actions and threatening actions, and then everyone leaves and goes to the party that is anti-China.
Do you feel like China still believes in peaceful reunification? So basically, on your words, it sounds like that's still something they would like if they can get a political party in power that would be more amenable to that.
Yes, and I think when you say peaceful, it isn't necessary. It can be non-peaceful, but not military, right? You have economic ways of levers of doing other things, diplomatic ways of pulling levers. You forget how much trade, just because of location, trade that Taiwan has to do with China. So, but yeah, I do think China fully believe there is a peaceful way or peaceful-ish way to reunify with Taiwan.
You know, one of the interesting things I read, Mitch, and this, I was surprised I didn't know it. And then I read it and I was like, well, I guess it makes sense, is that how much trade there actually is between mainland China and Taiwan, and how many Taiwanese citizens actually work in mainland China. And so there's a codependency there as well.
Yes, sir. And it's similar if you look back, if you remember Hong Kong,
yep.
Right? And how they were able to achieve reunification with Hong Kong. I think that is the model they would love to implement in Taiwan, because again, Taiwan relies on China a lot too, like you said, for working, getting over there, and the just amount of trade. If they were to cut off all those ties, Taiwan would rely solely on the United States, really, and being able to fulfill those needs to Taiwan.
Interesting. I'm sure Taiwan watches how Hong Kong has developed very closely and probably dislikes a lot of the ways that that has gone down.
Yes, that's probably been one of their biggest selling points, honestly, to that one political party. Is, yep, look what happened to Hong Kong, which used to be a bastion of economic capitalism and a really growing economy, and just freedom in general. And the change now with China being in charge of Hong Kong and the crackdown, the police measures that have happened there, insanely quick.
Yes, very quick. Well, Mitch, thanks for coming on today, and looking forward to bringing you back again. Thanks for the update. Any parting words?
No, but thank you, and good luck to getting to all our guys who are deployed out there in the Middle East right now.
Yeah, really appreciate what they're all doing. All right. That's Staff Sergeant Duncan. Thanks, Mitch.
Thank you.
All right. I think that's all I got for the month. If you made it all the way to the end, you're a real trooper. Thank you very much. Hope you enjoyed it. And that's the other thing. Put in the comments as well. Some feedback about what you like in the podcast, what you'd like to hear more of. Have a great drill, everyone. See you around.